Like, I remember Candace Owens played one of my jokes on her show. And I knew which joke it was. The joke was about it was so hard because she's awful, but God, she's beautiful. And then it made like some just terrible misogynistic Holocaust jokes combined, because that's what the joke that she liked was about.
Lovely.
You know, 6 million Jews on your back, something like that. And it's this mix. Yeah, it's fun.
Come on.
It's fun.
Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is Gianmarco Cerezi, a comedian and host of the Downside podcast.
And in the room, I would defend that, like, in the room, given the context and the trajectory of, like, who, again, the context of people in this room who know me and have seen me talk for an hour and who haven't fully set it up, I do think it's fine. I do think whatever. But my girlfriend just being like, it just feels like the joke is like, I'd fuck her. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're right.
Yeah.
Not a great joke. Mm. Maybe doesn't need to live outside this context.
Sure.
Maybe I don't need this to be part of my legacy. And then I have the additional thing that given mediums like this, I can also kind of say it and explain the context. And I get to indulge in it that way. I get to indulge in that whatever fucked up need I have to like express every thought to share it.
Sure.
And it feels good. Mm. It feels good, you know?
There should be some permission space where you can engage in those things, and maybe better to keep to the studio audience.
Let me say that.
Is there some kind of like, they call it negative polarization sometimes, where people kind of accidentally back themselves up into a position where like, oh, left-wing people are like retweeting me and saying negative things. So now I think I'm a right-winger. And then some big right-wing institution is like, oh, we'll pay for your next special. And then people kind of like find themselves in these camps almost by accident, it seems.
Yes.
I don't think a lot of comedians have these kind of firm, ardent ideological positions.
They're just that's like, not what we got into it for, usually.
I guess I'm part of this now.
I think absolutely, and it's kind of up to the comedian to decide how much they indulge in it and how far they go. And I do think there's some that one day looked out at their audience and said, how the fuck did I get here? And
audience capture, a moment of reckoning?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Everyone has a version of it. Everyone gets a degree of like surprise of like, oh, okay.
Have you been surprised by your audience?
Yeah. Two moments that happened. So I did one show and I was starting a joke about Charlie Kirk, and honestly it was tangential to Charlie Kirk, but I just said when Charlie Kirk got shot, and it was like a burst into applause, this huge applause and excitement, and this burst. Now I should add it was a furry convention that I was headlining, and
they have Nazi furries too now.
They do, the burnt fur community.
The what?
Burnt fur.
Oh.
Yeah. That movement's not making it. That movement's not making it. Okay. A furry community that wants to like unqueer furry culture. I'm like, good luck. Good luck with that battle. Okay. But so I remember I did it and it was like, and listen, the jokes I say are plenty disparaging of Charlie Kirk and his legacy, but it was just like right there, this huge applause. Mm. And I, in the moment, I played with it. I said a second time applause, and then I was like, when Charlie Kirk, like I leaned in, but I noticed from then on, every time I'd say it, people would applaud. And if I told it to people who you know, are friends of mine, but not fans, they go, oh, I can't believe that. And I go, well, you better believe it, because that's the temperature check on the country right now. Mm. Comedians certainly get a temperature check. Now, mine's very a polarized temperature check.
Sure,
back in the day.
You have a very specific sample size.
I do think pre-Trump's first win, some comedians would express that, like, they're on the road when they were actually getting a mixed sample size of whatever city and not just their ardent fans.
Yeah.
And they could see, oh, we're polling. Mm. Comedians are
you're polling in real time.
We're polling in real time, and now we all poll in the most biased circumstances. Our polls are now useless.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Because your audience is already like self-selected to a degree. But you were saying before the touring comedians that were polling in real time in Trump's first term,
before,
what were they learning through that polling?
I think they just got a sense of like people are annoyed with liberals. People like this guy. I think it's that thing. They like this guy.
Yeah.
Which was so unfathomable, certainly in my bubble.
Right.
Like, how could people like this guy?
It's most like people seem to like, this guy. It's kind of a situation right now.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you, the role of comedy has become, I think, much more significant in the last few years. If we look quantitatively, the biggest podcasts, the biggest things that cast influence onto our news media cycle are often shows hosted by comedians. Now, they tend to talk about politics, but how did these two categories somehow become the same thing, right? Why is every most popular talk show host a comedian who predominantly talks about politics right now?
I have to imagine, I blame mainstream media for being so god-awful bad. I think mainstream news is so dreadful. It is it is packaged poorly. It is.
You mean cable or you
cable,
mean
cable? I mean, I mean every single thing. You know, I see a 60 Minutes, but I mean like the way all politics was discussed, it just became so like gross and corrupt, and the sound bites and the battles and the satellite interview, like it all just became more entertainment based, more wrestling, more just combative.
Okay.
In a way that I think like it became indecipherable from, as comedy wanted to like, podcasts especially, like actually got deeper in a way that I think people liked. And suddenly they enjoyed listening to that more. This is all mixed with, I think, I don't know how dumb America used to be. So I feel remiss to be like, America's gotten dumber, because I'm like, well, I don't have a study of was it ever smarter? But it certainly feels like a lot of it is America getting, like if you look at Joe Rogan, and it's so easy to just go, look at this guy spreading misinformation. And I'm like, well, maybe when the news runs with a segment that says red wine is healthy for you, and then later they go, it's actually not healthy for you, and all these scientific claims are constantly packaged in a way that's clearly serving financial interests, and you do that 50 different times, and the science community doesn't know how to communicate. It was such a joke. Are eggs good for you? Or are they bad for you? Is milk good for you? Is it bad for you?
Yeah, eggs are a big
one. And I
yeah.
go, you start, people stop trusting anything. And it doesn't feel like there's any discipline to when you go, we know this, or we think this, or we have no idea, or this one study says we're not going to present it, that you understand why people stop trusting traditional news sources.
Yeah. The institutions are not trustworthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you see this guy who looks like an honest narrator. I want to, let's tap into this for a little bit, because I feel like particularly on the left and definitely in the podcast space, there's a lot of criticism of these big shows. But they are, however, quantitatively the most popular shows, like no contest, right? And so if we are on the left representing the interests of most people, how do we also get to say that most people freely making up their own mind and choosing to listen to these shows must be dumb or misinformed or what have you? Like, how do we balance those two things, right? A commitment to democracy, but then also sometimes most people will make incorrect decisions about not just red wine, but maybe let's say vaccines, for example.
Yeah. It's a big question. I think some of it's like, sometimes people want to like solve things like at the top level. And I'm like, unfortunately, it's not solvable right now. You can't, you can't change people's minds
right
unless you want to become unless you want to become a fascist government and, you know, hold everyone down and give them a vaccine. Unless you want to do that, it's like, you got to look at the educational system. And ultimately it's like, when it comes to vaccines, I could barely tell you anything about vaccines. It is just a general trusting of
the grander institutions.
Yeah. And I think what's always so shocking and frustrating about people who would listen to Joe Rogan or anyone who goes on it goes like, okay, I get the skepticism about big pharma and all these institutions. How did you then go then trust this one guy who's pitching a product? Mm-hmm. How did you go for, I know there's all sorts of problems. How did you look at RFK Jr. and go, but he's got my best interests at heart? That's the part that's mm-hmm. really hard for me to wrap my head around. Mm-hmm. If I have to choose between these two things, you know, I don't know how you get there, but I think it's about education at the bottom. Again, I don't know these things. I'm a comedian. Mm. But I think, like, if I were a scientist, I'd go, well, you got to learn how to package things well. You have to learn how to make things entertaining. You have to, we right now, certainly we live in a hyper entertainment space. And it's somehow educating people of, like, why would you trust the person that's funny for medical advice? Mm-hmm. You know, why? How did these two things get conflated? Mm-hmm. And I ultimately think it's because people are bored and they listen to comedy and that's all they listen to. That's their only intake. So if medicine comes in there, that's their only intake mm-hmm. of medicine. So what do? You make a science show that's more entertaining, so they tune into that too. You can try to talk to the Joe Rogans of the world and be like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, I would try to not give any medical advice other than comedically being like, I don't know, everything sounds crazy. But you can't just blame it on Joe. He's just some guy that a bunch of people, just shit talking.
What do you think about comedy being this permission space in society in which you can kind of break the rules of, you know, polite civil discourse, right? You can say a kind of edgy joke. You can slip things under that are not allowed elsewhere. And so as our legacy media has erected all of these taboos discussing certain things like vaccines, we don't have to marinate on this topic because we are definitely going to get demonetized talking about it. However, there's all sorts of things that have taboos erected around them. And so the truth can be spoken in these comedy circles to some degree.
You need a space where you can be flippant and people enjoy to hear the truth. And again, it's that balancing where it's like the news becomes... No one says fuck on the news. And then Trump says fuck in a thing and people go like, whoa, this guy's authentic. And I can totally see the pendulum swinging back where every news story is like, news from the Middle East. Fuck, holy shit, fuck. And then you go, okay, now I see why we developed decorum because but it went too far the other way of decorum where no one was saying the truth. And it's like with Epstein is like a perfect thing where it's like there was stuff to talk about there and no one in the mainstream news, who knows why they didn't talk about it. We know why, because they're connected. We know why.
Yeah.
and then it's like, I'm like, so you're mad that they went to the podcast people? Because they talked about it.
Yeah.
You sold yourself out. Mm. And that's why everyone is getting into, whether it's the independent journalist or whether it's the comedians, because they get to actually talk.
They fill the void that the legacy media can't.
Yeah, and those people are compromised too, though. Like, that's the thing that people can't seem to wrap their heads around, where they show that these conservative podcasters are getting grants from this, that, and the other.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's going to gradually be more revealed that everyone's compromised, and I don't know if we'll swing back to these institutions or somewhere in between.
You have something like a small donor campaign, I don't take PAC money type of equivalent for podcasts, where it's like, oh, my opinions aren't bought.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, though, so we're the same age. Do you remember, like, back when Bill O'Reilly was the biggest show on Fox, and then there were view numbers that you could compare Jon Stewart to Bill O'Reilly, right? And so at this time, we're probably in like middle school, but more people watched The Daily Show with Jon Stewart than watched Bill O'Reilly, and people thought, well, this is how the progressives win. It's just a kind of popular influx of this audience. And I feel like to some degree, like, we're actually responsible for this. Our generation of progressives is responsible for this because we started to put news into the responsibility of these comedians who would give you their editorial input with that weekly events in the news cycle. And then that format just kind of ran away, put the internet into it also. And then now we have this enormous platform for editorial voices, mostly on the right. And the process kind of ran away from us.
Yeah, it's hard because it's like, well, why did people flood to this thing? It was because, like, people like Bill O'Reilly, they were just so full of shit. And they were just presenting this, like, you know, what John Stewart, at least from my younger memory, it was just the thing where politicians would say this, you play the clip of them saying the opposite 6 months earlier, mm-hmm, and you reveled in this.
Those
like,
were very, very powerful. Yeah, yeah.
Very powerful, but ultimately
they
useless.
Also invented the crowd work outside of campaigns or outside of like rallies for presidential candidates, right?
Yeah.
Like the Daily Show would go around and talk to all these like dumb bumpkins at the Republican convention. And then like 10 years later, like Ben Shapiro realized, oh, we can do the same thing and liberals are just as freaking ridiculous. You can embarrass them on these clips.
Yeah, it's all failed. It's all failed. And I think like, I think also what when I look at comedy, when it felt, I had a friend, when Obama did Funny or Die, I forget when it was, and it was maybe leading up to
this is
Trump
when we're
versus
growing
Hillary.
Up. What? This is when we're growing up? When did he do that show?
No, I feel like he may have done it when it was Trump versus Hillary.
Okay.
It might have been like a get out the vote thing or whatever. Mm. But my friend like didn't like it. Like something about he didn't like the president engaging in this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember at the time I felt very much like, shut the fuck up. Mm. Like this is how you reach the youth.
Yeah, yeah.
And
right.
And then I do think I witnessed so much of these of my comedy idols cozy up to the Democratic Party in a way that felt, I understand the feeling because you looked at Trump and it felt like such an existential threat.
Better than the alternative.
Better than the alternative. But then they're cozying up to these corrupt centrist Democrats that are Republicans in their own right. And I can understand why a generation of people who like comedy were like, oh, fuck this. Yeah. Fuck this interview with Elizabeth Warren that's so like funny and blah, blah, blah. And, mm-hmm. and that's, they created that space.
Yeah.
So I also think like comedy didn't stick to its guns of like, fuck everybody. Mm-hmm. It's gotta be a fuck everybody type thing. And I do think plenty of people on the right are having a moment where people are like, wow, Ben Shapiro, he really seems perfectly aligned with Netanyahu. This seems like, huh? And I do think they're having that moment too. And I don't know. Like, I don't think I'm big enough yet to have influence. But like, for example, we don't have politicians on the podcast.
Yeah.
That's like just something that is my yet. Of course.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. But I think
it's going to happen to you.
It has. The offers have been made.
Yeah.
The cool offers I would have loved
to have vetting? Made. Are you vetting the candidates? Like, what's your policy platform?
But that's not what I want the podcast to be, ultimately. Mm. I want to be like, come here, not just for comedy, but I'm going to talk flippantly about things in a way that, like, you shouldn't take it as... And listen, I sometimes share real thoughts. Mm. But I don't want to bring on people... If I'm going to bring on people who have legislative power...
Yeah.
I have a new responsibility, and that's holding them to account, or else I'm just promoting them. I'm just helping
provide
propaganda.
You
got
to do a lot of research. You have
and
to
I don't
ask
want to
a
do
hard
that research.
Question.
I don't want that to be that. Mm. So that's my rule for now.
So I empathize with that, but I also feel like it is, it's like an attention economy singularity, that politics and comedy are just moving towards each other and they're going to converge. And so it is unavoidable. And so it's not fair and it shouldn't be this way, but it is this way. Mm-hmm. And so now in this, you know, unique, strange moment of history and media, thrust upon you, unbeknownst and unasked for, is all of this political responsibility.
Well, I'll talk about things. I'd love to talk about things. I literally think it's like, I don't want politicians. We once had a wrestler on, like a professional wrestler. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he fully understood, because at the beginning he was doing the interview like in his character. And I was like, well, there's a shallowness here that we're not doing the podcast. And I very, you know, stuck to my guns of like gradually gotten to be like, I'm not talking to this character.
Yeah,
I need to have a conversation with you.
Okay.
That's what talking to a politician is.
Mm.
And they're not dropping that character.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of them are good
at
it.
No, they don't. They don't.
Some of them are good at it. And I think when J.D. Vance comes on Theo Von's podcast, like, they're good at presenting what seems like a real conversation between two human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I go to Theo Von, I go, fuck you. Why are you providing that to this person who's not telling you the whole truth. We know that based on, you know, him calling Trump Hitler in 20 whatever, and now he's this, or you know, Theo Von will do one video where he's crying because he feels bad for Palestinian kids, and then has on J.D. Vance and doesn't bring it up once. Like, you are lying to your audience. And I don't want to lie to my audience. I don't want to lie to myself. I don't want to have politicians. I honestly don't want to know politicians too well that I would be scared to criticize them. And of course I've been tempted. I spoke at one of Zohran's rallies, and I, you know, I said, okay, it's the city that I live in. He can't be president. And I met him, and he was you know, you get it, charismatic and charming, and I was starstruck, and I would at other opportunities, should it be available, probably do something again. But if I start having someone on my podcast, suddenly I feel responsible for their decisions. If I know them personally, I might be more hesitant to go fuck this guy. Or really criticize, or really be a comedian about it. You know, the same way that news people have, you know, the corporate interest, they can't talk about Epstein because their boss was on the island. Like, there's a degree of, it's like, well, if you know someone personally, you are more hesitant to talk about them. And I just think I need to keep a certain degree of distance so I can feel free to talk shit about them. That's what I want my comedy to be. And if it strays too far from that, if you start being friendly with these, with people in power, when does it become propaganda?
Have you maybe fallen into a niche where I've seen you do a few routines about picking up political audiences almost by a sheer accident of social media? Like, do you feel like there's a kind of responsibility now thrust upon you by having, you were outspoken about a few issues maybe a year ago that accumulated a whole new audience that maybe wasn't familiar with your work before?
People, I mean, you know, there were times people, oh, I hope you were going to joke more about Israel. And I was like, I don't have a joke about it. My challenge is more like, okay, if I have an audience that agrees with me on a bunch of things, how do I write jokes that make them go, oh, like, because I like that. That's what I want my comedy to be. I don't want it to be pandering.
I was going to ask you about
if
some of that.
If they applaud on the setup of a line, that's fine. Like, if the setup to a joke, they applaud. Like, for me, I think you see my belief. You can see my beliefs in the setup. That's fine. I don't want the punchline to be an emphasis of my beliefs, because then that's pandering. Then I'm asking for applause or approval because you agree with me. If anything, I want you to trust my heart. I don't know. I don't care, really. But I want the joke to be funny even if you disagreed with me. Now, the setup is going to reveal, you know, what I am. You know, the setup's going to be, I'm a trans ally. The punchline cannot be, I'm a trans ally, because that's pandering. The punchline should be, I'm a trans ally for the most insane, funny reason you've ever heard, and you understand that's a joke. And that's the challenge for me, as opposed to a responsibility. I think my responsibility is I want to be funny still.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon. You're a little based curious, perhaps. I've heard you challenge your audience.
Based curious. Oh, yes. Yeah.
I've heard you challenge your progressive audience on some issues.
Yes.
What for you is then a successful joke, right? Because there's a huge phenomena of audience capture that's very present now. And there's a lot of, like, you know, ego rewards. There's also a lot of financial rewards of just catering to the same people. So what makes a successful joke where you provoke your audience in some cases? There's been overreach in the past few years. I've heard you speak about this before, right? And people on the left can sometimes sound censorious. They sound like speech police.
Yes, okay.
That has been catastrophic. It's backfired in many cases. So how do we, having these predominantly progressive audiences, how do we challenge them in ways which are productive?
Mark Maron put it well in a recent podcast. Mark Maron put it well in a recent special of his where he was just like, we're annoying. The left is annoying. And I think that is like a starting point.
That's an example.
And so, yes, I think like part of it is it's somehow investigating those sensitive things that maybe you're not supposed to talk about. And especially sometimes, like, they don't want to hear a white guy's perspective on it, understandably, but can I make a joke that makes you go, but have we thought about it this way? So, like, a joke that I'm, like, still working on right now is, and again, let me just preface this. A joke never works comedically outside of the context of it. So it's just presenting the idea. And oftentimes when people just hear the idea, but this is the beauty of comedy.
Yeah.
It kind of like greases the wheels to discuss.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I'm on board.
Okay, so in this recent one I put out, it was about like, I worry that we canceled too many actors. And it didn't matter when it was the untalented ones, whatever. But I'm worried we canceled enough actors to make a pretty good movie. And it was basically saying, like, the problem with canceling these people, and I maybe I preface it or I used to, of like, I'm not saying they didn't deserve it. And that's my, like, listen, I hear you.
Sure.
I'm not saying, I'm not going to give you a list of 10 people I think we should forgive or what lines we should make.
Okay.
But I go, they still exist. They're still alive.
They do still exist.
These actors still exist.
Mm-hmm.
And they some of them want money, some of them need money.
Yeah.
And they're not gonna go away. They're going to work in projects that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are really talented. Now the non-joke version would be like, listen, I think some people are so talented that maybe we have to adjust the rules for them, because if we cast them out of society, they will use those talents for even worse things than you can imagine.
Ah.
Now, that's not my, I'm not putting that as a policy proposal.
Artistic deterrence?
It's certainly a thought.
Okay.
It's just a thought of like,
yeah.
And sure enough, Jonathan Majors is going to do this movie for The Daily Wire.
Yeah, you have the greatest propagandists of your generation, and then you cede their tools, their ability to the other side,
yes.
to your opponent, maybe.
And again, the comedy, non-comedy would be like, thus, we should accept what Jonathan Majors did to this woman. The comedy is like, this is happening and it's really bad. And then I go further. And if in this, I go, you know, if Israel makes a propaganda film starring Kevin Spacey, written and directed by Woody Allen, produced by Harvey Weinstein with an R. Kelly sound, with a P. Diddy soundtrack, I'm going to see it.
Mm.
And like, again, and that's where again, that's a joke. I have absolutely seen things and indulged in artists who have been quote unquote canceled by the most of the mainstream. So it is a joke, but it's not a joke.
Yeah.
And there are some people who would look at that or go like, fuck you, I don't like that. And that's fine. And it's on me to go, sorry, that's what I believe.
I do
believe we unethically consume so many things. I don't think art for some reason. And ultimately, I think if you police people's art, it backfires tremendously.
This is kind of a big deal right now. I'm going to summarize something that will only be of interest to you and me, but people will maybe be familiar with the phrase blue chip art. This is like the fanciest art at the biggest galleries. It's super expensive. In the last few years, Annie Armstrong wrote about this. It's called red chip art. And it's artists who are equally financially viable. Their work is just as expensive, but they don't come up through the usual institutional vetting process. They're showing in different galleries. They're published in different magazines. But it's the same amount of capital in circulation. And so when you see these things, or when you exclude them from like the proper channels or the permissible channels, like this hideous monstrosity appears to come back to haunt you. And I feel like there's a similar thing happening in entertainment and comedy where like when these people get canceled, they kind of show up on the other side in weird instances. You had mentioned before about bad comedy on the left. What might be an example of bad comedy on the left?
I think bad comedy on the left is one where it's less reliant on being funny and it's more reliant on feeling like you're right and or you're morally good. I just don't think that's the same thing as what comedy.
It's kind of like Rob Schneider for progressives.
Yes, and it absolutely is. It's there all the time. It's especially for me. It's a lot of like, well, Trump's a bozo, and everyone's like, yeah, or someone's like, it's like.
Great.
Someone's got to do something about this guy. And I go, well, go storm the Capitol. Mm. Like, but there's so much.
Okay.
Like, we got it.
I think we tried that once.
Not the right people, but it's like, it's just this, it's, to me, that's always one of the most frustrating because I'm like, you're right. Do we want to go do that?
Hmm.
Or are we just here reveling like someone should? Mm. Wouldn't it be
that
nice
was a
me-
that was a meme a couple months ago. Someone should. I'm not going to say that.
Of course, but there's it. Again, you can still talk about that, but then you have to have funny, or it's not comedy. Or instead of what comedy, it is just like a, like we all agree. And if that's what you want, I don't see that as comedy or good comedy or comedy that's going to sway people or move people or shake people up or bring in an audience of anyone other than people who go like, yeah, I do think that.
Is there some kind of flip that has happened in the last few years? Whereas when we were growing up, there was this transgressive and rule-breaking quality to art and entertainment, and now it kind of feels like progressive media is holding the rules in place.
I think so, but Charlie Kirk was a very perfect example where I suddenly was like, and we're back to my childhood of conservatives saying you shouldn't say that.
Yeah,
and
that's
it was nice only because I ultimately, most comedians in general, even if they don't fully publicly express it, will usually be more on the side of like, you should be able to just joke about, not necessarily hatefully, but like, you should be able to tell jokes about anything to a degree.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
It was just nice where the people I so ideologically disagree with were also contrary to my beliefs on like speech.
And so is this a moment where this thing can kind of flip back again, right? Because I was thinking about the Epstein files too, like, Alex Jones has spent his entire career talking about like elite ritual child abuse and cannibalism and all this stuff. And now like he's like, he can't touch it at all.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, it's a nothing burger. That's his like position on it. Trump is, you know, completely implicated, but also can't talk about it. And so there's this space that's kind of opened up for progressives to be like, actually the elites are engaged in some pretty dark stuff. And maybe there's this like permission that flips, where the conservatives are like, oh, don't talk about that anymore. They're no longer on the side of like free speech as they were for the basically up until October 6th.
Yeah, it's challenging because I do think so. I mean, obviously, like, I think part of the reason people gravitate towards like the Hassan Pikers of the world is they talk like a little bit flippantly. They talk aggressively. They curse. They're willing to just say some shit, and that allows a space again to be comedic, to be flippant, to speak truth to power in a way that people find exciting. But it's always hard. I think it was hard before, where, you know, the people who are now more right wing, where they were like, well, why can't I make that trans joke? Why can't I make that gay joke? Why can't I say the R word? And it was tough to square sometimes, because it's tough to police. It's tough to police language without being the police.
Right.
I don't, you know, I think my personal belief is that like, it's always going to be kind of a losing battle to police language. That language is ultimately, I don't have a good metaphor for it, but it really is like the last thing. It's about the core beliefs and society, and like, If no one says the R word, but you have a society that doesn't care about disabled people, who cares about this thing?
Sure.
I'd much rather have a, and I think ultimately these two things, just because it's so easy to identify language.
And you can also shame your peers for behaving the wrong way. In some cases that benefits you and your upward mobility in like elite fancy institutions.
Yeah. We don't live in a good world. And do I need to add this fucking shit on top of everything that a disabled person is going to deal with? While the other part of me, as a comedian, I look at, you know, some of Louis C.K.'s best bits. I look at George Carlin. I look at some of the greats of all time. And I go, wow, they had a real freedom of language. I am more cautious in a way that I don't always like. At the same time, I think I'm more politically honest and mean, or than some of those other people that have the more freedom of language. We all choose. I think I talk about political violence in a way. In my mind, I think at least this last thing I was working on, like talking about Charlie Kirk in this way, did feel like something that some of those free speech warriors, those ones who were did not touch with a stick. And I want to say, fuck you. Mm-hmm. You want to say the trans joke, but you didn't believe this freedom of speech. And I think I think that's the problem. I struggle with it. You know, like,
well, it is very difficult because you don't want
to
sound.
A lot of people
sound...
say to you, "Hey, fuck you. Why do you need to say that?" And I don't. You know, I can say to them, well, like, what does it matter? This word exists. It said here, it said there, it said there. It said by some comedians you like, you just don't want. But at the same time, it's like, but why do you need to? And it sucks because it ends up feeling so, it becomes the conversation. When the conversation should be about like our deeper cultural dealings with people. So that's why, at least in my mind, and again, this could shift. It could shift if I think of the greatest joke of all time, but it could shift. But ultimately, I go, at least right now, I'm not going to censor other people saying it. I'm not going to say it as of right now, because the internet takes something and spreads out the context. There was a beauty before things were filmed where you could go to a club and you did get that feeling of like, when we're in this space, we're gonna really.
It's actually.
We're gonna
private.
Really. We're gonna. It's actually private. Yeah. We're all kind of friendly, and we're gonna push it even more.
This is a big deal in comedy right now, right? Because like people are afraid of having their sets. Like they're afraid to test out material because everyone is filming at the club.
I do believe another thing that the left did that was challenging it, but I don't know the solution. Is they said, how dare you platform these people? I'm sure you've dealt with this.
This platforming stuff is like ridiculous, bro. This is, I mean, how do you...
It is ridiculous,
but like... you're platforming the president in some cases. It's like, how do you... What are you, platforming the most famous person on earth? Like, quantitatively, this doesn't make any sense. And also, it's a hesitancy. It's a fear to actually engage with disagreement at some point.
It's a fear to engage, but why do people feel that? Because...
They feel that because they can't defend their positions. That's why they don't want someone platformed, because they know that the things that they're saying will appeal to a large audience of people who will agree, and they won't agree with them, who has this niche minority
activist. I would argue that the
position.
Reason people are against this platforming is because they've constantly seen so many interviews where the... I didn't like Andrew Schultz having Trump on the pod because I go... Well, you're not gonna talk to him about Epstein. You're not gonna talk to him about these things.
Yeah, he is horrible. He is a terrible interviewer, and his political takes are garbage. So yes, his platform will just be utilized.
But that's
exploited.
Why people are allergic to platform. It'd be fine. I mean, this is why I go
like the
I need
boys
to step
with
away.
Netanyahu.
Yeah, this is why. Yeah, of course. Of
literal
course.
Fucking Mossad agents in the background.
And that's why. That's why it is tough. Where it's like, if you're gonna. That's why I go, I want to stay away from politicians, because I can have someone on who I disagree with politically if I can go to their face. If I can't go to their face, fuck you. I don't want that to be my show. I want a show where I can do that.
The problem is now that we don't have the constraint or the monopoly of legacy media where you had to go on CNN. To reach an audience, you had to go on CNN or MSNBC or Fox or whatever. And there's only so few venues that you could access that many viewers. Now, because you can pick between 100 different podcasts, people can self-select and go on the one that's going to be the most friendly.
Of course.
And so there's not really a solution for that unless you decide to like nuke YouTube and go back to the old media model. It is actually a real problem, because then these people can be, if you can't buy Tim Pool, for example, you can buy the next guy, and there's 99 people after that.
Yeah.
And so politicians just get more and more friendly interviews, and nobody is actually diving into the you know, hardcore issues in the way that alt media used to do. That was its promise.
But that's why...
Legacy can't talk about this, and so alt media will go into it. And now it's just the opposite. It's more exploitable. It's more exploitable by people with capital.
Of course, but that's why, like, ultimately you have to make an entertaining show that people, like, really tune into. You have to make a show where, like, the politician has to go on that show if they want to get their word out, and has to take the risk of, like... Like, I think a lot about, like...
But we've got... So we have that right now in the form of Rogan. right? Like that is kind of like, that is as much as there is a monopoly, it's just the sheer concentration of audience where people have to fight to get on that spot.
Yeah. Yeah, that but then is, he doesn't, and then he doesn't really challenge them, or he's just a fucking idiot and just like kind of is high and goes along with it. I think about like, I don't know if this is a crazy thing to think of, but like in a rap battle, if okay. you were to see, if you're able to get two people in mm-hmm. a room in front of an audience, mm-hmm. and you see who walks away mm. the winner, it changes. Debate? I mean, it makes me think of like Kendrick and Drake, where like it was this cultural thing where like when you heard that song, you're like, fuck, it's over. This person's mm-hmm. point uh-huh. won uh-huh. the day. And I think yeah. there's so much of like, and like Jubilee will try to do it in this way that's so overwhelming, where they have yeah. the 20 people and the one. And that's entertaining, but it's not necessarily informative. I don't know.
It's pornography for discourse.
It's pornography
for
discourse.
It's a discursive gangbang.
But it is interesting. I do see Jubilee. It's a spectacle. But it is interesting to watch that coworker that or someone you disagree with to have like an expert mm. like who knows how to address them. And I feel sympathy for, you know, the whatever scientists go, fuck, I don't know how to do public communication, mm-hmm, mm. but you need to, or you need to find the Bill Nyes of the world, the younger Bill Nyes that are aggressive or flippant. You need the Hassan Piker of science. And I hate when people, Joe Rogan to the left, Hassan, but like a scientist who goes, fuck you, and is willing to talk in a way that's interesting if you want to get in there. And it's up to the audiences to demand those things. Like, you should debate that person. You should do that boxing match. I think we need a little bit more of that.
Do you know comedians who have made, like, a right-wing pivot in the last few years?
Yeah, honestly, I feel like that particular dialogue, you can't make jokes anymore, has kind of faded to a degree. Mm-hmm. I do. Well, to answer your question, I do know some comedians okay. who have pivoted there, and everyone has its own origin story of what got them there. Mm. I know one in particular where it was about the vaccine, and again, this is all what
because
I see of the
because
public
of
persona.
Touring.
They weren't people, allowed in some venues in New York
right.
that they normally performed at because they yeah. didn't get vaccinated.
You had to have the card to get in.
You had to have the card. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though I saw people bypass that system quite easily. I worked at a club called LOL Comedy Club. It's closed now. But I just remember someone didn't have a card and the bouncer said, just show me your phone for the security cameras and I'll go like this. And yeah. then you can go in.
You could also just like Xerox the thing. You could uh-huh. just make a copy of someone else's and
yeah.
make a fraudulent card.
Yeah. But that certainly for him. Now, who knows what radicalized him first?
Sure.
A comedian named Matthew Broussard once said, like, nothing radicalizes a comedian more than not being on TV for 12 years, which is very true.
Yeah, yeah.
You get okay. mad. You get mm-hmm. mad at the world. Mm-hmm. So I think like this particular person, it was a mix of that the vaccine stuff, it was, I think there was also, they were an actor, mm-hmm. and there was definitely a significant segment of time where agents or managers or other people would say things kind of bluntly of like, we're not looking for a white guy right now. Just was mm-hmm. like, and it was so hard to discuss in any way because mm-hmm. If in my position, if like you were talking about it, it just sounds like you're making excuses mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and complaining while you're not working. And acting in Hollywood is one of the most inauthentic ways to like learn about what's really going on because everyone's working in their own self-interest to such mm-hmm. a deep degree, mm-hmm. No matter what side of things
you're
looking
at. What do you mean learn about what's really going on?
Like if someone's complaining about the diversifying of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Deep down, they wanted to be on SNL.
They wanted the spot.
And they're not going, like, they don't even care about the greater diversity or their fellow white guy comedian. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be on it.
Yeah.
Only 12 people get to do this in each generation.
Right.
And so just people's, it's so easy for the emotions of your exact dreams not coming true to meld in with whatever's going on politically.
Yeah.
So there was a degree where it was like, there was a degree where Hollywood was striving to be more diverse. I would argue sometimes in a lazy way that backfired because they didn't actually like seek to find new areas to get talent. They just looked at the pool in front of them. But if you were to go on the road as a touring stand-up comedian, you want to talk about a lack of diversity. Mm. Like, if you're looking for a lack of diversity, that's alive and well in the traditional comedy club circuit. Mm-hmm. So there was a degree where it's like, yeah, you're the one thing you wanted to do, that the marketplace has changed. And the response just became so hardened. And then that right-wing turn starts coming in where suddenly other people are mad and suddenly the jokes... The comedians are responders to what people are laughing at and ticket sales. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly, more people agree with that one opinion. And before you know it, you've just gone further and further.
Where are ticket sales pointing? Are they pointing towards like the increasing diversity in the field, or are they pointing towards those?
I think they're just more fractured. I think
polarized?
Definitely polarized. Okay. Polarized and just dictated by the algorithm that like it's incredible. Like, it's so funny because I would try to mention Sebastian Maniscalco probably several times, the highest paid touring comedian in the world. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of comedy spaces where if you reference him in a joke, some people get it and some people don't.
Okay.
If you were at Seinfeld at a certain time, everyone got it.
Sure.
Everyone's intake is so fractured. Mm. And some of those are politically polarized. Some of them are just, you know, they're really into TikTok or they're really into this app. Some of it's app divided. Mm-hmm. Some of it's politically divided. Some of it's, you know, topic divided. Some of it's like, it's, you know, women in their 20s talking about their dating life. And I would have never heard of this comedian because it just never came in my
algorithm.
It
is entirely possible to be a very big act right now and not to have name recognition across a large number of people.
Like, yeah.
You and your neighbors have very different news feeds.
And big at a different scale. Like big, like you could sell at Madison Square Garden, but you're not necessarily going to be a movie star because of that. So it's, you know, I don't like the polarization nature of it, but it is nice because I think more people have an opportunity. You know, when you ask people the average Joe, who's your favorite comedian, or they say, I love comedy.
Who do they say?
It's Seinfeld, Kevin Hart, Chappelle, maybe Bill Burr. Like that's just maybe Sebastian is there after staying at the top for so long. Mm. But, you know, it's rare you're going to hear a Doug Stanhope out of just someone who the average Joe. And maybe that's good. Maybe it's good to have less people at the top so there's more people making a living.
That's a question right now, because I think the asymmetry of the resources in like the Web 2 economy, right? Because, there were a lot of like in the institutional model, a lot of people who were held back, who were talented, but we're not given the green light by whatever, investors, whoever's in the middle.
Yeah, whoever runs the Tonight Show with Johnny
Now
Carson.
We have, the gates are open, so everybody can post to social media, but you see this immense, unprecedented concentration of wealth at the top. So there's more people in the field, and as you were saying earlier, there's more people in the field, but there's only those like 12 spots on SNL. So they're increasingly competitive. And then, especially when you have a society with no social democratic infrastructure, you have these white men who are trying to get into these middle class spots, and then they're deprived of that opportunity. It's like a direct kind of route for them to go to the right. I think the problem
or
is
to
that
the left.
For,
I mean, there's space. I mean, people can be supportive of the left too. Like,
split either way.
Anger is obviously, I think it's an easier sell. But I'm just saying, like, anyone can find these pockets. Hmm. You know, I just think the one on the right is so.
The audience is the pocket.
I think the right wing turn, it's just like the map of it is so clear. Mm. The infrastructure of it is so clear. Mm. The different podcasts, the different shows. politically how to respond. I mean, I would argue that sometimes some of it's just tied to bad writing. I think
bad comedy writing.
Bad comedy writing, where I feel like to my mind, whether it be racism or homophobia or kind of these simple things where ultimately it's like, ew, or get them out of here. Mm. And the joke is just on that. Mm. It's such a basic joke. So I think a lot of bad comedians or a lot of ones who are lazy gravitate towards that because they can find an audience that will laugh at you going like, gay.
Okay. And give me a name for this. Is there someone in particular that you have in mind?
No, I was reading something. It was recently. It was Rob Schneider was opening for someone, and I was listening.
Is he going to say it, or do I have to say it?
I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot. Even when you said that, I was like, I got 20 I could say. Uh-huh. And some will play with that and are still great comedians, but like people like Rob Schneider, I think I feel pretty fine saying. It's not like I've watched a lot of his stand-up.
He's doing specials on like Fox Nation or something now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. From what I've gathered of his stand-up, it's bad.
Gianmarco Cerezi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon.